You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Finley Medical Clinic. We serve uninsured, underinsured, and insured individuals. Open Monday through Thursday from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Urgent care clinic Friday and Saturday from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Call for an appointment at 414-988-3079. Finley Medical Clinic is accepting new patients. Vaccines and screenings for uninsured, underinsured, and insured. Located at 10721 West Capitol Drive, Suite 110. Call our office for an appointment today at
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
You know, I'm so tired of waiting. Aren't you? Waiting for the world to become good and beautiful and kind. Let us take a knife and cut the world in two and see what is eating at the Rhine. Langston Hughes. Greetings, Hotep brothers and sisters, and welcome again to the Black Reality Think Tank. I am your host, William Rogers. So happy that you could be here with us this evening. Really a dynamic show. When I think we turn off the system and equipment tonight at 9 o'clock Central Time, those of you who are on, could you please just kind of silence your phone? I'm getting a lot of feedback. A lot of feedback in 919 Durham 872. I'm getting a lot of feedback. Please silence your phone. I appreciate it. Thank you so much. These are, you know, kind of real sensitive mics. But anyway, I'm so happy that you all are here with us. As I said, when we go off the air tonight, I think you're going to go off feeling real good, because we're going to be talking about a part of our culture and our history that has made us feel good. And so tonight we're going to be talking about that world and doing some things. But before we get into our discussion, there's a couple of things that I had on the agenda that I want to do that are very critical, that are significant. Tonight and to our discussion, I wanted to pay tribute to this program to a very dear and close friend who transitioned last week. His name is Brother Neil Shandick. He was one of the great jazz pianists locally here. He was a teacher, educator at the Conservatory of Music here. And we just want to kind of do this for Neil. I had kept in touch with him over the years. We used to talk a lot on Facebook. I knew that he was in the hospital with COVID, and he was struggling, and it was getting rougher and rougher each day. So we wanted to just make sure tonight that we honor him with this program. And if any of you who may come on know him and know his work, if you just want to say a few things, we would greatly appreciate it. I think our guest tonight does have some relationship with Brother Neil. He played all over the city here in Milwaukee, as well as in other areas, too. So we just wanted to say hello to him. And then the second thing I wanted to do, I wanted to highlight, the outcome of some of the work that was done here in Milwaukee and has been done other places with our youth. As you know, those of you who are regulars to the Black Reality Think Tank, we are always talking about our youth. We are always talking about education and the things that we can do to help in that process of educating our children. I mean, you know, we talked that. One of the things that I constantly push is Saturday schools. And we've had a couple of programs over the last couple of weeks where we looked at a model coming out of New York City that was very, very instrumental in training and raising up and restructuring young people and restructuring their mind and waking them up to life and to what they need to do as they move into adulthood. So tonight I have a young man. When I started the Black Reality Think Tank about, I would say about 15 years, maybe, yeah. No, not quite that far. Maybe about 8 or 9 years I started it. And I started it right after the death of my daughters, and I used it as an opportunity to suppress some of that pain and to just kind of keep myself awake. And so I had a young man that I knew his dad and had worked with his grandfather, over the years in Milwaukee. We had worked with youth. He ran a program for the Opportunities Industrial Centers of Greater Milwaukee, and where we were mentoring young people and young men, creating mentoring programs. He had hired me as a mentor trainer, that I would train the mentors who would actually mentor the kids. We used to run workshops and do all kinds of programs. His name is Mr. Philip Scott. Great visionaries. And he also had youth just like I did. He hired one of my grandsons to teach chess. And he had his grandson, and he was working with him. Well, last week I got a notice in the mail that his grandson will be graduating from high school this year. He has been accepted with a four-year scholarship to San Diego State University in San Diego, California. It is a football scholarship and an academic scholarship. And Brother James, his name is James Scott, and I'm going to introduce him to you here in a minute. He's here with us tonight. Brother James used to come on when he was in middle school with us then, and he would do the ancestral profile. And not only did he just do it, he would research that person. His father would have him use a podium stance. He would present it at home, and he would do it on Facebook and himself, and he did it faithfully every single solitary week that we were on the air. Like I said, I've been on here. This was in 2015, around that time when he did it. This is 2022, so he's done 7-8 years. He did it faithfully. And then we moved to this network, and so we kind of stopped doing it in the way that we were doing it at that time. But nevertheless, he always stayed connected with us. It's definitely his dad. His dad, his granddad was instrumental in helping me to even organize some of the first programs that we used to do on the Black Reality Think Tank. And I've never forgotten that and so appreciative of him. And when I got that news, I was one happy camper because, you know, I knew that James could accomplish those kinds of things. So, as I said, and I'll let him tell you a little bit about what he got. I'm not know the full details. I know he has a full ride, San Diego, play football. I don't know what position he's going to get. He'll tell you that, as well as an academic scholarship. So he's not just a jock. He's not just a jock. He is a smart young man, and he will be leaving, going there in the fall of this year. His name is James Scott. So let me introduce him to you. Mr. Scott, how you doing, my friend?
Hey, Dr. Rogers, I'm doing well. How are you?
Good. Why don't you tell us, first of all, what you got?
Are you talking in terms of football?
Yeah, your football is your scholarship, yes.
Yeah, so in pertains to that, it's not quite a full ride, but my complete tuition is paid off and some more.
Oh, that's full ride.
I have my grandparents to help me with room and board is all that I have to.
Okay, you got to do that, yep. Mm-hmm. Okay, and what position are you going for, James? What will you be playing?
I play running back.
Okay, all right, good. And again, it's San Diego State, right?
University of San Diego.
University of San Diego. Okay, great. I will make sure I got it right. James, let me ask you real quickly. I'm not going to hold you long. I told you I wouldn't hold you long because I know you're still in school and you got to do work. But what do you think was 505-8568. Could you please just mute your phone? I'm getting a lot of feedback. Okay, thank you so much. Appreciate that. James, could you kind of give us an idea of what were some of the key factors that contributed to you being able to move through the year? Because I always got reports on you and what you were doing. But what do you see as some of the...
I think it was definitely my grandparents had a huge role in part in it, always continuing to keep my head and my mind focused on what I was supposed to be doing. I think as I got to high school, a lot of kids kind of veered off into the partying and drugs and things like that, but that was never really my path going on. I always knew what I wanted to do, and the fact that my grandparents continued to put me in positions to accomplish my dreams and goals, Mm-hmm. They're definitely a key factor and a big part of why I'm at right now. And of course, I can't go without thanking my Lord and Savior Jesus Christ and God Himself, because without Him, nothing is possible. So keeping my faith in God and keeping my mind on what it was supposed to be on was ultimately what got me here and my grandparents.
Great. Beautiful, James. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. How do you think being able to do some of the things that you were doing with the Black Reality Think Tank might have supported your ideas? Because I know you were conscientious in doing that work. I watched you very carefully. What do you think were some of those factors?
Yeah, that definitely helped me in so many ways, especially when it came to researching and public speaking, and when it came to being able to stay focused and really get into depth in my work, which ended up transferring over to, you know, school and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Once I got to school, I implemented the same work ethic I had on the Black Reality Think Tank in school once I got to high school. And, you know, continuing to have good grades is definitely why I'm able to go to a prestigious institution like the University of San Diego.
Beautiful, 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 beautiful. Okay, James, well, listen, I'm not going to hold you. I know you have to go. I really appreciate that. I just wanted our audience to see what can happen when we put our attention on our children and focus with them and stay with them to the end. These are the kinds of results that we can hopefully respect. And James, I watched him. I watched him climb. And James is a very handsome young man. He could probably be a big time partier if he wanted to. but he kept himself focused on what he needed to do. And his parents made sure he was focused. And his stepdad made sure he was focused. And we used to talk a lot about things. And, you know, there were some days that were rocky roads, but that's okay. They overcame them. And now look at the results. Take care, James. Keep in touch now. I want to make sure you keep in touch with me. Let me know your progress, okay?
All right. Yes, sir, I will.
Thank you now. Take care.
You too.
Okay. All right. James Scott, very beautiful. But these are things that we just need to highlight every now and then when we talk about results and talk about some of the things we're doing. Some of these things work. And it's what we're trying to do. We're trying to make them work. As the great Ray Charles say, we're trying to make it do what it do, baby. You know, and that's exactly what we see in this young man. Okay, we're going to get started. We are night. We're talking about the world of jazz. Had a great introduction in music to the great Hank Crawford as he opened up with his rendition of Lift Every Voice. And it was powerful. We're going to get into it. So I want to start off. I have a wonderful guest with us tonight that's going to help us carry this conversation forward. I will start off tonight. First of all, I want to go back and I want to play something that very clearly will kind of help us understand a little bit about what we are doing. This is a piece created by the great Wynton Marsalis because he had a very favorite out of New Orleans, which is supposedly the home of jazz. And he used to talk about tremendously over and over again, the great Buddy Bolden. And so I want to hear this a little bit, and then we're going to come back right into our one-on-one conversation. But let's take a look at this, see what you think. We can kind of incorporate this in our ideas as well. Wynton Marsalis and Buddy Bolden.
When you come right down to it, the man who started the big noise in jazz was Buddy Bolden. Yes, he was a powerful trumpet player, and a good one too. I guess he deserves credit for starting it all. Mutt Carey.
And out of all of this comes Buddy Bolden, dark-skinned Negro from the church. Buddy Bolden's innovation was one of personality. So instead of playing all this fast stuff, he would bring you the sound of Buddy Bolden.
Buddy Bolden, the first musician celebrated for playing jazz music, was born in 1877, the year Reconstruction ended. Only one dim photograph of him survives, and little is known about his tragic life. But from the first, Bolden seems to have been different from every other cornet and trumpet player. Louder, bolder, more innovative, and eager always to surprise and delight his listeners with the richness of his musical ideas.
Buddy Bolden invented that beat that we call the Big Four, that skip on the fourth beat, or so legend has it. The Big Four is when you accent the second, fourth beat of a march. In a strict march, you'll be going, don'ch, 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 don'ch. With the Big Four, you go, don'ch, 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 ga-don'ch, don'ch, don'ch, ga-don'ch. So on that fourth beat, the drum and the cymbal hit together. And that point is where jazz music started to really get its lilt. Before the trumpets, they were playing. But now I have the Big Four. Boom, 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 da-dum, boom, 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 boom. So when I phrase it, I'm going to make it sound like me, and I'm going to play with another entire feeling and groove and use all the different growls and shouts and cries. So now it becomes. Make it sound not like trumpet, but like Buddy Bolden. Now, you're also listening to the clarinet. So the clarinet might play a little something, and you have to stop playing. So you might say, he's playing at the same time. Everything is organized a certain way, but at every second, all of you are making a decision to make that music stronger and to organize that music more and more. That's jazz music.
Like other New Orleans musicians in the first years of the 20th century, Buddy Bolden played everything. Waltzes, mazurkas, schottisches, polkas, rags, and spirituals. But he was best remembered for his hot music. And he played it all over town. Perseverance Hall, Masonic Hall, Jackson Hall, and the Union Sons Hall, which at night became the Funky Butt Dance Hall.
Nobody took the hats off. It was plenty rough. He paid 15 cents and walked in. The band, six of them, were sitting on a low stand. They had their hats on and were resting. Pretty sleepy. All of a sudden, Buddy stomps, knocks on the floor with his trumpet to give the beat. They'd all sit up straight. They played Make Me a Pallet. Everybody rose and yelled out, "Oh, Mr. Bolden, play it for us, buddy. Play it." And I'd never heard anything like that before. George Baquet.
But after midnight, the night people took over. And that's when the blues and the slow drags really begin to predominate. And so the repertoire changes. And Bolden gets away from the polite and he gets into some of the more impolite. It's a different kind of frenzy. It's one that's kind of internalized with a hot, humid, sweaty night. Everyone's kind of moving languorously on the dance floor. No one's trying to wear it out and spend their energy too quickly because they literally want it to last all night long.
on those old, slow, low-down blues, a fellow musician recalled. Bolden had a moan in his cornet that just went through you, just like you were in church or something. By 1906, Buddy Bolden had become the best-known black musician in New Orleans, now hailed as King Bolden by the children who gathered in front of his house each morning just to hear him practice. Bolden was especially beloved in the black section of the wide-open red light district of New Orleans called Storyville. There was nothing like it anywhere else in America.
New Orleans was the hotbed of that type of sexual activity, and we weren't Puritan. In jazz music, it says, this is what we do, and it's beautiful, and it's also terrible. Then jazz is real. It deals with that man and that woman. It deals with depraved things, because the musician saw all of these things. That's what gives our music its bite and its feeling, and that's what the world wanted from our music. It didn't hide what went on under the sheets.
The apogee of Bolden's career coincides with the best years of Storyville. Everybody wanted to come to Storyville and sort of check this thing out. It was like the Casbah in North America. Well, there was a sporting life associated with Storyville, and Bolden lived it. But there was a cost to be paid, and Bolden drank heavily. He began to miss gigs.
Bolden had always been a heavy drinker, but now he started to develop headaches, began talking to himself, quarreled with the members of his band, and worried constantly that other musicians' innovations would overshadow his own. He seemed frightened of everything, even his cornet. In September of 1906, he set out to play in another parade, just as he had done for years. But somewhere along the way, he abruptly walked away from the other marchers. His mother did what she could to calm his fears, but nothing seemed to help. 6 months later, she was forced to call the police, afraid her son would hurt her or himself. Buddy Bolden, the man who had led the first jazz band, would never play his horn in public again. He would spend the rest of his life in the Louisiana State Insane Asylum at jazz.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Hotep again, brothers and sisters. We are back. We are talking about the world of jazz. Just got that little introduction on the great Buddy Bolden. And as I said, Wynton Marcellus has done a marvelous thing in re-bringing up the brother. They've done a film on him called Bolden. If you haven't seen that, you should. It's a powerful piece, very important in terms of African-American culture and our history. So I guess the question becomes, as we start off this discussion, why am I doing this? Why are we doing this on the Black Reality Think? Why is this necessary? African people living in America have endured some very, very, very difficult times. But as James Weldon Johnson said, even in all of that difficulty, we have survived. We have been able to stay on our feet. We have been able to keep moving forward, keep getting up, keep pushing on. And one of the things that clearly supported and helped us to do that is our belief in, number one, the spiritual power that was always a part of us. And number two, our art, the spirit of our art, all of it, all forms of it. It's what Dr. Karenga labeled as Kuumba. It is the Kuumba spirit that rests and abides in us, that keeps us surviving, keeps us fighting, keeps us moving. I know many of you have seen Big Mama get up in the morning, go in there and start cooking biscuits and eggs, and she turned that radio on and you know what's playing. And she's got that music to soothe her. And she's listening to the Mahalia Jacksons, and she's listening to the Pilgrim Jubilees, and some of that music that is just a restoration for her, and the rest have been a restoration for our people. And then in some cases, they listen to the jazz of the Buddy Bolden, the Louis Armstrong, the Pearl Baileys, and others. And that music was always something, too, that lifted us up as a people. So we're looking at the union, that intersection of struggle and music and art, and how that worked and how it has worked and how it will continue to work in the Black family. And I think it's an interesting thing to look at and talk about. It brings joy to me just to hear it and to know that we've survived and we did this on our own. We didn't have to get anybody to come in and set this up for us. We did this naturally. We did it in the holds of slave ships coming across the mighty Atlantic. We used that spiritual realm of things as we sort of embraced and embodied those challenges that we were enduring. We used it on the cotton fields of Greenwood, Mississippi, the cotton fields of Alabama, on the cotton fields of Georgia, as we would dig down and pull up that cotton, blood all over our hands, as we were pulling that cotton from those thorns and that cotton seed and put them in that bag and dragging that bag around all over the place. We did that, but we survived. We hummed, we moaned, made our music, and we felt good. And to some people, it was mesmerizing. To the European who was sitting on that ship that day, and he was listening to those Africans down in the hold of that stinking, funky ship with all the feces and urine and all of the diseases and stuff that was down there, he listened to them sing it, and it befuddled him, knowing that the inhumanity that had obviously been implemented against our people. So that's what we're doing tonight, and I've invited a guest to help us read through some of this, because we have some very powerful folk that have introduced this for us and have done a wonderful job. This, my brother, has agreed to come on, and he's going to help us kind of, he's a musician. I'm going to have him tell you a little bit about his name, but his name is, I'm not his name, his work and the musician, the music that he plays and so forth, and what was his focus. His name is Olusegun, and I want to make sure I pronounce it right, Sijuwade, Olusegun Sijuwade. And he is a wonderful brother. He has a very strong family. One of the members of his family is one of the hosts of one of our programs called Warrior's Way. And he is going to come tonight and talk to us. So good afternoon, my brother. How you doing? Brother Olusegun? Are you there? Oh, wait a minute. I'm sorry. I was getting some back. Okay, Brother Oluseekin?
Hello, can you hear me now?
Oh, yeah, I got you now. How you doing?
Okay, good. How are you?
Good. What did you know about Buddy Bolden? Did you know anything about
him? Well, the first I heard of Buddy Bolden was short, is that he was one of the pioneers of jazz, but there's no recordings of him.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, a lot of people made it sound like he was a myth that maybe didn't even physically exist. And it was more of an ideal, like jazz was created by somebody, but there actually was a real Buddy Bolden.
Okay.
And I'm glad that Wynton Marsalis, you know, made the movie about him to give substance to it.
Yes, he did. He stretched. He did a lot of research and dug him up and really gave us a chance to see how significant he was. So I'm so happy that you are joining us. Before we get into our conversation I just want to ask our brothers and sisters again, those of you on the phone, I'm getting a lot of noise in the background. It's very distracting. If you could please just mute your phone, I'd greatly appreciate it. Only my host, he obviously can't mute his phone, but everybody else, you can. Brother Oluseekin, some of that's coming out of your phone, too.
You hear some sound?
Okay, now it's better, but some of that background was coming out of your system. It's very sensitive.
I was definitely moving things around on my desk, and they may have picked that up.
Okay, that's what that is. All right. Yeah, these phones, the mics are very sensitive, and they can't pick up. Okay. All right, so tell us a little bit about your musical beginnings. What do you play? And, you know, give us a little background to that.
Well, I'll start by saying that I play my father's saxophone. So, you know, that implies that you said we had a strong family. My father was a saxophone player. He had a band. The first instrument he told me was clarinet, and my parents are from Mississippi, my mother and father. They started a band when they came to Milwaukee, and she was the singer. He was the band leader. He put together a band that had drums. It was an R&B blues band and soul band. Bass, organ, and two guitars. And they would play all the Motown records and sax records of SCAX and other soul records, you know, from labels that primarily were R&B and blues and black music. They would learn those records and play them to a T. Like, they could play every note exactly the way it was in the record. Which was impressive to me because they could match that musicality. And then that I could, you know, see people from a young age, cause all the practices were in the basement of our house. From a young age, I would see people pick up instruments and just play them masterfully. So I knew that to be good, you had to practice because I saw them practice all the time.
Right.
And that they had a respect and appreciation for the music. What I didn't know until, like, decades after the band had dissolved and even after my father had passed and some of the other musicians had passed, that one of the reasons that they learned all that music to a T was because they were a backup band for a lot of the artists that they were learning the music from for those records. So when the Shy Lights came to town, Shy Lights came in the Midwest, you know, my parents on the weekends, they would always go play in Racine, Chicago, somewhere like, you know, out of Milwaukee, and they would be backing up those vocal bands. And I didn't know this until decades later. And I think my mother mentioned it to me when she mentioned about going backstage at Potawatomi a few years ago to see Shy Lights, and they remembered her and the band from backing them up back in the day. And also, she mentioned that so they were known to be a really good band. So one day they went to go see Kool and the Gang, and Kool and the Gang called my father's band on stage to come jam with them. And again, growing up, I didn't know about any of that. They just, to them, music was something that they did because they enjoyed it. They did it on the weekends. It was also extra income. But they didn't envelop that, any of that to us growing up. I didn't know until much later.
Okay. All right. Now, what was your instrument of choice?
Saxophone.
Say it again.
Saxophone.
Okay. All right. Good. Tennis.
Yeah.
Tenor.
Yeah. So when I say I play my father's saxophone, I mean literally I play my father's saxophone.
Okay.
So I mean, growing up, I looked at all the instruments in the band, and the bass I actually wanted to play, but I wanted to play the saxophone, but it looked like the hardest instrument. The bass looked easier.
Right, right.
But I also like the sound of the bass too. But the saxophone, you just see all the fingers and all the keys, and then you have to blow, and it's like, man, that's a lot of stuff to do. It's like everybody else, the guitar and the organ and the drums, you know, they could just play the instrument with their fingers. They didn't have to do any breathing. But the saxophone, you have to seem like there's a lot more involved.
Yeah, a lot more action going on there. Yep, you're right. You're right.
I mean, that was my perception at the time. And then my father had another saxophone that he let me learn on, and he showed me some licks after I was able to get a sound from the saxophone. It took me a while. And then after I got those, then I was trying to learn how to play like him. And he had a lot of jazz records, and that's when I started getting into jazz, because most of the jazz records they had, the band never played anywhere. Like, they never played any jazz gigs. It was mostly R&B and blues. Well, maybe they did. I don't know if they did any.
Right.
But he had a lot of jazz records. Like, he had John Coltrane and Gene Ammons, and a lot of Gene Ammons, and some Stanley Turrentine. And I would start playing with those records on my own, like, just trying to learn how to play those solos.
Right, right, right. So in a sense, it was kind of like passed down to you, right? Yeah, all of this was passed down. It was a part of your father's. It was a part of your father's joy and the work that he was doing. Okay. Now, was Milwaukee at that time conducive to that type of music coming around? I know we had the Conservatory of Music here, so obviously there'll be something. What do you think?
During my father's time, I believe it was. I know that Mel Bryan was here at that time. He was still alive.
Oh, yeah, right, Bryan. Right.
And Berkeley Fudge was playing a lot.
Yeah, Berkeley Fudge.
Berkeley Fudge was playing a lot until his stroke a while ago. He had a stroke several years ago. Berkeley, Manti Ellis.
Right.
And there were some people that left Milwaukee that were great back then. Alto saxophone player that died not too long ago. Bunky Green, he's also from Milwaukee. He was a famous alto saxophonist, one of the great alto saxophone players.
Bunky Green. So let me ask you. What do you think draws people to jazz? And I know it's an individual thing, and I'm not kind of asking to be able to decipher that, but there's got to be a universal kind of principle. Is there something to jazz that you think people are drawn to that can hold them and hold their attention? Because sometimes some jazz can be a little abstract, but most of it, you know, people start listening, they next thing you know, they're moving their heads and shaking their feet. So what do you think?
So it's interesting that you say that, because a lot of people say that when they hear jazz, usually the jazz that sounds abstract to them is either bebop or avant-garde.
Right.
And avant-garde is the later, 60s and 70s, where it sounded like this a lot of the people, cacophony.
Right.
And bebop, what Charlie Parker, Miles Davis, Dizzy Gillespie pioneered, and it was a lot of but Charlie Parker or Adam Windmore, some of the say velocity, like a lot of fast notes moving and a lot of chord changes. But before that was swing, Duke Ellington and Count Basie. And it was like Buddy Bolden, it was like a generation of the march music that was dance music, and you could swing to it. So people liked that. It was like I remember my grandfather in Milwaukee going to see Count Basie on 20, he said it was on 27th and Walnut. There was something there that he would go see, and my grandfather loved to dance.
Right.
But when bebop came along, it became more of more of like something that you would listen to more than dance to, so you could appreciate the artistry. Melvin Ryan told me that playing bebop was like being a doctor or a surgeon. Like, it's not something that you do without study.
Exactly.
So for a lot of people, they figure out, like, what is the artist trying to say or what are they trying to do? I can't find the beat to dance to. I think people that are attracted to it, there's been a study that shows that a lot of people that are engineers, computer scientists, mathematicians, were also jazz musicians.
Right.
The former, he worked for the president. The person in charge of the Federal Reserve under Clinton was a good tenor saxophonist.
Right. I know who you're talking about. Exactly. Yep. You're right.
And he actually sat in with John Coltrane one time because he thought he thought he was good enough to sit with John Coltrane. And so he must, you know, obviously he could play.
Right.
But you know, as far as people have become musicians, a lot of them are people that have kind of a somewhat of a mathematical, not mathematical, scientific. Logic-oriented kind of mindset. And that's, you know, talking about bebop, because the different periods of jazz kind of attract people in different ways.
Now, you know, that's right. That's right. 80s, that's right.
Yeah, you had the fusion-based jazz, which is kind of like a rock-based jazz.
Yep.
And now you have what's called smooth jazz, which a lot of people say is not really jazz, it's just pop music with instruments. And so people listen to them with different expectations.
Right. And I think that's really what I'm trying to get at tonight. There seems to be stages of the way people grasp jazz. Now, I think during those hard years, I'm still getting that feedback, Brother Osuna. I'm still getting the feedback from your phone. But
my phone?
Yes. Because I get a lighting your module lights up when noise is coming from back there. But it stopped now. It stopped now. I don't know what that was. But anyway, Leroy Jones, who, you know, became known as Amira Baraka, wrote a book called Blues People. And I read that book. And he says that a lot of it went along with the struggles of our people at that time. And during those hard years of segregation, and Jim Crowism, and the hangings and lynchings, a lot of the music, and particularly in the jazz realm, was that music that was upbeat, lively. You know, it was the one that, you know, you could get in the barrel houses, you know, the ones that, liquor houses and stuff like that. It would have a jazz-type beat. They would have that Louis Armstrong stuff. And some of that along with a coupling of not only just jazz, but the blues. At that time, the blues and jazz were heavily mixed. You had people like Big Bill.
Well, that's that period of, yeah.
Go ahead, I'm sorry,
that's
go ahead.
That period that people called hard bop.
Yeah.
Horace Silver, Max Roach, and it went back to like from, well, I won't say it went back to, but it infused more of the church, the roots of, spiritual music into the jazz. Max Roach was one of those jazz musicians. He's probably one of the great.
Yep.
No, he is one of the jazz drummers of all time, but he was also very political.
Right.
And,
very
political. His freedoms, a lot of his music and albums were based on going along with what Amira Baraka said about protesting what he saw was happening to black people around the world.
Right.
Same thing with the singer.
Yeah, his wife,
with,
right? Abby Lincoln.
Knew what it was like to be free.
Yeah.
Abby Lincoln. And they did things together.
Yeah.
So in the 60s, especially a lot of black, and Charles Mingus, his tales of Fobbes against the racist police down in the South.
Right.
They pit their music out there with this political overtone, and you know, a lot of times they suffered for it too, because you know, some record labels would drop them, or you know, this was at the time when Muhammad Ali was banned from boxing because he wouldn't go to Vietnam.
Right.
So I mean, it was much easier to do the jazz artists. I think Thelonious Monk was even, his life was taken away. He can perform at New York clubs for like 11 years.
Okay. So it's kind of that's when that bop era came in, right? That's when
the hard bop, yeah.
Yeah, that hard bop came in. And then Miles Davis would come along and slow it down and do something called cool jazz. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. Yeah, so that was like a little bit before, and the cool jazz was, you know, people called it that, you know, like, I don't think that's what Miles was thinking. It was, you know, he was, and people from the West Coast were more known for, like, that kind of more thinking, cerebral, brainy type
okay.
of jazz.
Okay, all right. Okay.
Versus the East Coast, New York, hard-hitting, soulful
yep.
kind
yep.
of jazz.
Yeah, yeah. So it's kind of like it's regional. It's based on the struggle. We also saw that in rap. When rap began to come along,
mm-hmm.
you know, it began to have a
yeah.
regional effect to it. And you heard, you know, used to hear them talk all the time about East Coast rap, West Coast rap, you know, and sometimes it became conflictual, and then other times, you know, they came together and did things. But it's interesting. And so the point that I'm making is that it's going along with the struggles of where we are as a people. Because when you got off from work in New York on Friday, that was your last day of working, you were tired, you just got your paycheck, you still ain't going to be able to pay all your damn bills because you ain't enough money in there. But when you go down to the juke joints and you hear Big Bill Brunzy saying, come on, baby, rock me one more time, you know, you can that eases out. For a minute, at least for a few minutes for the night, and then Monday morning, like Doug Fast Domino said, the Monday morning, Blue Monday, you got it again. You know, and so all of that music was feeding into the mindset of our people as we were going through our stuff, struggling. Now, let me ask you this. What about the South? Jazz in the South, was that late getting there? Was that something that just wasn't happening down in Mississippi and Alabama, the Cotton Belt?
Well, shoot, that's where it came. I mean, you talk about New Orleans, that's where it came from.
But I mean, they said it took that Route 66, you know, which means that it went around some of that. And down there, that's where you got the blues. You picked up the blues.
Mm-hmm.
You picked up that hardcore blues.
I think the artists and the bands, they follow where the gigs were at, you know. So, you know, the big bands were traveling, and, you know, people wanted to hear people in New York and Kansas City.
Kansas City, that's right,
Harlem,
Kansas City.
That's where they wanted to hear, that's where the audience was for big band music. Because, you know, in the beginning, it was mostly big band music because it was coming out of marching bands.
Right.
What's up for Louis Armstrong with his Hot Five, Hot Seven? He had the kind of a smaller group.
Okay.
And his music, like Louis Armstrong, was revolutionary. I mean,
back
then, I mean, he was back in the '20s. What, you know, John Coltrane was in the late '50s and sixties. It's like, you know, they didn't think jazz could sound like that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I think, you know, people were going where they could get the job, and so that was New York, Chicago. That's where the big bands were the biggest in the Midwest, the East Coast, and some of the West Coast. And that's where the studios were. Down South had more of a lockdown on, like you said, the blues.
They got the blues,
you know,
yeah, right, exactly.
People would go to see that more.
Right.
You know, and that's just kind of,
right.
They were just going where to work with that.
What's the guy's name? Fats Waller. Fats Waller, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
New York, he had an age and an era and that was really bad. I remember he had a song called Your Feet Too Big. He, you know, and it was really, it was culturally connected and all of that at the same time. Mm-hmm. But he played those liquor houses. They had rent parties in New York. And they used to make their rent. And those guys came there and they played that music. And that's what created, I don't think the radio stations were doing that much stuff. What about the radio stations, to your knowledge? When did they really get on board with jazz and blues?
Oh, boy.
What do you think?
And that was hard. I want to say.
Yeah, I know, because.
I want to say that was probably, well, I mean, actually, you know, I mean, people, Louis Armstrong was famous in the, with radio in the 20s and the 30s. He was famous.
Right.
Because it was okay to play, you know, black music on the radio because the black people weren't coming into your house.
Mm-hmm.
And it was even okay for them to play at the club as long as they played on the stage and it went out the back door.
Right, exactly.
But when it came to how many more venues? Like, I think Duke Ellington can only play in so many venues, but Benny Goodman could play in a lot more.
Exactly.
Made a lot more money. A
lot more money,
like, I think Benny Goodman sold a lot more records. And, you know, there's a lot of radio stations that just wouldn't play black music, period.
Yeah.
So we got on some radio stations, but not a lot. And so a lot of them were played. Like, they thought that the best, I'm not saying how you can say who's the best, but they thought that the best big band during the time of Duke Ellington was, like, Benny Goodman, or because they just didn't know who Duke Ellington was. They didn't know that that's who influenced Benny Goodman, or that's who influenced the Paul Whiteman band, or, you know, like, the difference between Dixieland and New Orleans was just the color of the musicians. Dixieland musicians were just white. They played the same music that Louis Armstrong playing, but they were white, and so they could get into more venues,
right.
And get played in more stations.
And I think that's the.
I don't know that it's changed that much. I don't want to cut you off. I don't know that it's changed that much because I think radio and the media now still favors European-based musicians and black musicians. So I don't know how much that's changed. Black musicians can make money, and they're, you know, I think their culture is appropriated because a lot of musicians make. That aren't black make money off of, you know, the kind of the sound
and,
of sounding black.
And then the other thing is going to be have a lot to do with when blacks start owning their own radio stations or, you know, taking over the music part. We talked about that a few weeks ago. I've got one of our listeners and regular supporters to the Black Reality Think Tank, Dr. Bruce Bridges. He's a historian. I'm going to ask him to come on in a little while. I think he's online. And maybe he can give us some of that historical background of when the radio stations start opening up, you know. And I mean, because a lot of them weren't owned by blacks; they were working in there. Because I remember Symphony Sid was a part of that movement. He was white, but you know, he was playing black musicians. And I don't know whether he could do that. He did that on his own. Inklings, or did he do it, you know, based on what the station wanted? He worked at all white stations, but, you know, but very clearly all the jazz artists knew and understood the work of Symphony Sid, and even to the point they made music, a song about him, King Pleasure. King Pleasure made a song called Jumping With My Boy Sid in the City, Mr. DJ, Mr. President of the DJ Committee, you know, kind of thing like that, you know. In tribute.
Yeah, it's like that with Atlantic Records and Impulse Records.
Yeah,
you know, they're owned by white people, and was,
exactly,
they were the ones that recorded, you know, Miles Davis and Rollins and very few black recording companies were around or allowed to be around because, you know, it's hard to.
You know, this is so much stuff that we could talk about.
Stuff,
right, and obviously you can't do it in 2 hours. I want to open up the lines, give our listeners a chance to come in and join our conversation. I just wanted to get out the main facts between you and I before I did that, just kind of, you know, for us to chit-chat about it. And, you know, we still can do it. We've got some more things that we can talk about. But it's kind of getting close to the top of the hour, and I want to do a couple of things and then come back. But one thing before I go, before we take that top of the hour break, is let me ask you this. Things began to switch as we moved through the 50s and 60s, and the civil rights movement came in. And it seemed to have brought in, people that were all there, but you had the Dexter Gordons, John Coltrane, the Miles Davis, the Lionel Hamptons. You had all of that cadre of brilliant musicians. And they were doing things. Where were they coming from? Where did they get their training? Where was Dexter Gordon's training? Where did Hank Mosby? Where was Herbie Hancock? Where were they, Quincy Jones? How did they get that start in that music era? Because when they came in, I mean, it raised the level of the quality of jazz music to like it has never been before. So what is your understanding of how all of that came about in terms of the musicians themselves personally and their training? Where are they getting that training from?
So that's a very good question, because in the early stages of jazz, it was all mentorship. Now you have jazz institutes, you have colleges with departments, with jazz departments.
Right.
People can go on YouTube. People can. There's books that have everything written down. You can buy books that have the solos of every note of John Coltrane, Miles Davis, Lionel Hampton, all the Dex Gordon, everybody that you just mentioned. Like, there's somebody that's taken all their solos, and you could just learn that.
Somebody has their phone and they're dialing a number and their line is over. Could you please silence your phone? Thank you. Okay, I'm sorry.
So nowadays you can literally learn a lot about jazz just sitting in your own room and watching videos or doing online classes. Back then, you had to know somebody. Like, you had to, if Dexter Gordon wanted to learn jazz, in a lot of his own interviews, he talks about going to hear the famous people play. They usually started with an instrument. It was saxophone. It was popular back before the 1970s that you're supposed to learn clarinet for some reason. I don't know why.
Right.
Supposed to learn clarinet first, and then you can play saxophone. So a lot of saxophone players back then could play clarinet. And everybody like Herbie Hancock, like, they would start off by playing classical music. Some of them came right up out of the church, though.
Oh, yeah, okay,
but eventually
right.
They would get to where they could find someone that could play the music at the level that they wanted, and they would just listen to them.
Right.
When records came out, they would play along with the records, and then they would try to, get in the band and just play, if they were in a big band, they'd just, they'd play on the side. They were a side person in the band. And a lot of them, like Charlie Parker, was known for practicing like 9 to 10 hours a day. Like, they would just practice stuff. Dizzy Gillespie said that when bebop came along, because it was so complex that if people want to learn how to play bebop that were playing music before, and they were even accomplished jazz musicians, he told them that you first need to learn how to play piano. So, at Dexter Gordon and John Coltrane, like, they could also play piano in addition to their instrument. So you could understand how the chords and the melody and how the parts of music and the harmony, how they all work together, because it became so much more complex.
Okay.
But they basically was mentors. So, like, they played with people. Miles played with Charlie Parker, but before he played with Charlie Parker, he played with other people. Well, Miles went to Juilliard, but he's one of the few exceptions. Like, he actually went to Juilliard, he was classically trained first.
Right, I know.
But, you had to get with people, and then.
Yeah.
It was slower back then, but you got the music.
Yeah, I know they say Thelonious Monk had formal training in terms of his what stuff that he was working on. There's two other points. I'm gonna wait and ask a couple of them after we leave. What does it mean when somebody says they play by ear? What does that mean?
No. So a lot of people say they play by ear because they say that they can't read sheet music, so they just pick up the song when they hear somebody playing the music. So somebody could be playing or singing a song, and they'll just pick up the melody and play it on their instrument or they'll sing it. A lot of people learn music off the record that way. Like, if you put the music in front of them written out, they wouldn't be able to play it, but they could just pick it up, listen to it, and then they could play it on their instrument. So you have to really know your instrument, and when you hear a note, how do you play that note on your instrument? But after a while, it's automatic. Like, you can, like some people, I think Art Tatum was like this. He was known to be able to listen to a song all the way through.
Okay.
And then just play it note for note. There's a jazz bassist now, Chrissy McBride. They say it's the same way. Like, you can listen to a song and then start playing it without even practicing. You can just he memorized all the notes in his head as he was listening, and then he starts playing it. So
right, exactly.
It's a skill, but you get it. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, listen, I'm going to go on and take a break here and come back, and we want to open up the lines to our audience. I want to talk about a couple of other things. I want to ask you about the demon of them all, drugs, and how that got into how that got into this game, because that wanted to definitely wipe it out. So we want to talk a little bit about that and give me what you know about that world in terms of jazz music. So we have, and then we want some of our audience to come on and give us their experiences with jazz music. Even if they are personal players or whatever the case may be. But anyway, let's take a quick break, and we'll come right back.
Okay, sir. Peace.
There I go. Pretty baby, you are the soul who snaps my control. such a funny thing, but every time you're near me, I never can behave. You give me a smile and then I'm wrapped up in your magic. There's music all around me, crazy music, music that keeps calling me so very close to you, turns me your slave. Come and do with me any little thing you want to. Anything, baby, just let me get next to you. Am
Hello?
I insane or do I really see heaven in your eyes? Bright as stars that shine up above you in the clear blue skies. How I worry about you, just can't live my life without you, baby. Come here, don't have no fear. Oh, is there a wonder why? I'm really feeling in the mood for love. So tell me why. Stop to think about this weather, my dear. This little dream might fade away. There I go talking out of my head again. Oh baby, won't you come and put our two hearts together? That would make me strong and real. Ooh, when we are one, I'm not afraid, I'm not afraid. If there's a cloud up above us, go on and let it rain. I'm sure our love together will endure a hurricane. Oh, my baby, won't you please let me love you and give me relief from this awful misery?
What is all this talk about loving me, my sweet? Not anymore, not like before. Don't you understand me? Now, baby, please pull yourself together. Do it soon. My soul's on fire. Come on and take me. I'll be what you make me, my darling, my dear.
Oh, baby, you make me feel so good. Let me take you by the come, let us visit out there in that new promised land. Maybe there we can find a good place to use a loving state of mind. I'm so tired of being without and never knowing what love's about. James, Woody, you can come on in, man, and you can blow now if you want to. We're through.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Okay, we're back, my brothers and sisters. This is the world of jazz and the African-American experience. Thank you so much for being with us here this evening. This is also a very, just a real small thought production tonight on behalf of a dear brother that transitioned earlier last week, whose name is Brother Neil Shendick, one of the great jazz pianists of this area. We miss him truly. He was a good brother, very kind, gentle spirit. I remember many days with him at the Jazz Oasis nightclub, which was right on the corner of Holton and Meineke in Milwaukee, and sitting down with him and talking about everything. And so I spoke with him a couple of days before he passed, and I know he was going down. He was on respirator. COVID had hit him. And so we're going to miss Brother Neil. We're going to miss Brother Neil because he was a very good brother. And he had played around the city. He did a fabulous program at an art gallery, one of the great art galleries here in Wisconsin, in Milwaukee. Art of Health Art Gallery on King Drive. And I remember him sending me a text and told me, man, I didn't know that was in Milwaukee, you know. So even he was exploring some things. But taught at the Conservatory of Music here. But just a good brother, and he's truly going to be missed. So we're here with our dear brother, who is also a local jazz musician and has done a lot of things here. He's come from a very large family that are musically inclined. His mother was a singer. His father was a jazz orchestra leader. And he's just got tons of folks that line that. And he himself has been heavily in the jazz music world. His name is Olusegun Sijuwade. And he's here and he's helping us kind of chop it up a little bit about jazz. So we're going to open up our lines and let's see what our audience has to say. As we are doing that, Brother Sijuwade, what do you think about the drug world and what happened to that in jazz? How did that get so messed up that you had a genius like Thelonious Monk, John Coltrane, Jimmy Smith, who got sometime hung out there on that stuff? What happened? What's going on in that world that made that happen from your perspective?
Well, you know, first of all, everybody, because I actually work in crisis intervention, so I know everybody deals with drugs and has encountered drugs for different reasons, personal reasons. And like, there was a lot of musicians, famous musicians, that said because Charlie Parker took drugs, they thought they couldn't play that way unless they took drugs. I think Sonny Rollins said that. Like, he drank a lot and took drugs because he thought, well, if I want to play like Charlie Parker, I also have to. So they were emulating what they thought would needed to be done to get them to that level. And of course, you know, they all said later, like, no, that had nothing to do with their ability. It was the practice and the learning that gave them the ability. It didn't add any soul or substance. But I want to think about Louis Armstrong, biggest musician in the world at the time. The golden age of jazz from the 20s to the 50s, to the 40s, jazz was like the biggest music in the world. Like, it was bigger than anything else. So, right. Know, Louis Armstrong would be like Beyonce today.
I agree.
But, you know, when he went to clubs, he had to go in the back door.
Mm-hmm.
And then he couldn't stay in hotels. You know, if he ate food off a plate, they'd break the plate. I think Charlie Parker was in a hotel like that once. And when he knew they were going to break the plate, he sat in front of the lobby in the fireplace, and he started throwing the plates in the fireplace. And they were like, what are you doing? It's like, well, you're going to break them anyway, so I'm saving the job for you.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that weighed heavily that he was revered by people, by the producers and the concert promoters, But then they told him, but you can't, you know, eat with us. You have to go to this other part of town, you know. If you're in his town, you got to be out of his town before dark. And so that played on him. And I think Louis Armstrong, his biggest thing was, like, marijuana. Like, I think he was a functional marijuana person for the rest of his life. But a lot of it, I think, was self-medicating. John Coltrane, you know, when he made Love Supreme, it's because he finally got off of the drugs. But, again, he thought part that he... When I read of his interviews, it would help him play like Charlie Parker. He said, no, it didn't. It was, of course, his obsessive practicing and learning that did it.
Right.
You know, when people got off of it, they didn't want to be on it.
Right.
You know, when they finally got off, Sonny Rollins got in trouble. Van Getz got in trouble. Like, right. They actually did criminal things because of the drugs, to buy drugs. And when they got off of it, they were like, man, I don't know what I was thinking. But they were, again, dealing with, they were supposed to be like these great people. But people treated them like they were trash because they're like, oh, but you're really black. Right. Except for Stan Getz, he had other issues.
Right. And they're actually real people. These are your next door neighbors. These are your friends, your people down the block. And they have average lives. They're not anybody above that. They're average folk that happen to have a wonderful gift that they can share with us. Yeah, you're right. And but let me ask this, though, from a musician's standpoint of view. And I think most of the time Hollywood misses the point on some stuff because they're obviously trying to make a picture. But I read something not too long ago. When they did the movie Ray Charles, when they did Ray, that Jamie Foxx played in the movie. Actually, Ray Charles was sort of sanctioned that. He did go along with it. He was a part of the production.
He was teaching Jamie some stuff.
Yeah, consult. So, okay, here's the question. What is it about that world? Is it the playing? Is it the hectic it is? The strength, the stress, and that's on you, that makes you need something to soothe your spirit? Or is it that when you're playing, you're in a world of another place, in another space and time, and then when you stop playing, you're out of it, so you need something to take you back there? What is it about that makes you voluntarily, as in the case of Ray Charles, John Coltrane, need to do in taking those drugs? Because, I mean, these are smart men, and they know what those drugs would do to you. And they know what they are doing to you. What do you think it is about the experience of playing jazz that makes it necessary to numb your spirit in a minute, you know, to do something?
Well, jazz doesn't make you do drugs. I think people, like I said, I think they mistakenly thought they needed the drugs to think the way that they heard, you know, Charlie Parker or Miles Davis playing, because it was so new. There's like, where did they get these ideals from? But, you know, they just looked at the music differently, and they had different ways of expressing things. But I think, again, it's personal. Some people thought they could emulate people because that person was on drugs. Some people did it to self-medicate.
Right.
Billie Holiday was
Billie Holiday.
You know, she had two voices. She had the voice before she was heavily addicted to drugs, and then she had the voice that was rough, that she's kind of more famous for when she did Strange Fruit, that was more ravaged by alcohol.
Right.
But she was also kind of like entrapped by the U.S. government. There was a guy that was trying to arrest her, and there's a documentary, and so he arrested her for heroin, tried to destroy her career, when other people that were using it were just treated in a hospital or clinic. But you know, he wanted her in federal prison.
Right.
And so, and, you know, growing up, Billie Holiday was sexually and in all kinds of other ways abused. So, again, she probably began self-medicating before she even became a musician. And for a lot of black people that are great jazz musicians, like, they were, again, you know, growing up in the United States, you're oppressed before you even learn how to play your instrument. Like, you already see it going on. And you may be thinking that, okay, once I become this famous musician or athlete or artist, then they'll start to treat me and my people better, and then it doesn't happen. It seems like it gets even worse. Or
right.
It seems like it's more like they were just, using you to get what they wanted financially.
Right.
And so, again, I think people, you know, for the same reason that people use drugs that don't play jazz, like they're trying to deal, they're trying to lessen some type of pain. But
okay.
jazz in and of itself is not a music or I would say any kind of music that demands that you go into an altered mind state to play it or master it.
I got you. That's what I was kind of gritting that. Was there some of that involved? I mean, because we all want to.
I think it's like athletes that think that if they want to be a world-class athlete, they have to take steroids.
Right.
But no, you don't have to take steroids to be a world-class athlete. But some think like, well, there's no way I'm going to be at the top.
Right.
Well, the music is the same way. Like, you don't need that to think a certain way.
Exactly. Because, you know, we all want to avoid pain. Nobody wants to be hurting. And mm-hmm. if I can take something, you know, I'll take something. I take Tylenol every day, extra strength Tylenol for arthritis,
mm-hmm.
you know, to kind of kill some mm-hmm. of the pain in arthritis. It does help a little bit. It doesn't take it away, though. It still hurts. But, you know, I try mm-hmm. to. I would like to be able to smash it all the way down. But I don't want to take mm-hmm. I don't want to take those drugs that can do that. When I first retired, my doctor subscribed fentanyl, and
mm-hmm. oh,
he
okay.
did. He did the patch. I had to take a fentanyl patch and put that patch on every morning, and
yeah.
it helped. It definitely helped, but mm-hmm. the side effects. Oh man. I would rather the pain than the side effects. And so I let it go and stopped, cold turkeyed it. You know, and he said, I'm glad you did that because it was killing your liver too. You know, and those drugs hurt your liver as well. So you're right. I'm just worried about that. Okay, so listen, let's see what our brothers and sisters here have to say. Brother Timothy, how you doing tonight, my friend?
Oh, very good. This articulate young man gave us a lot of information, man, and I can relate.
Right.
I'm going to say this about
people
discriminated against. The Billy Eckstein believed me coming in the front door, Jack. That's what I like about Billy Eckstein.
You know?
What? I'll tell you. But I'm going to say this, sir. I think
the people... For Lee. You wanted Lee's number.
Yeah, did you get it?
Yeah.
Can you do me a favor? I really appreciate
it. Is something
you
wrong? Is something, something going on?
Call this number. Tell him what I wanted, because I'm on the air now.
Wait a minute. What's going on?
Could you ask him that we wanted
is it clear
to
now?
And just talk a little bit about that. About
is it clear now?
Neil, say a few things about
is it
Neil.
Clear?
Okay, on your radio show?
Yeah, it's 215-490
okay.
9832.
Okay, so you want
to. Are you ready?
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Lee Majors is his name, right?
Right. No, Lee.
Okay.
Lee Foster.
Lee Foster.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Are you ready now? Are you ready?
Oh, go. What's, Brother Timothy, you finished?
Yeah, no, I didn't finish. No, I didn't start. I never start. Somebody interrupted. I couldn't.
Oh.
Is the young man still there?
Okay, that's all right. We were trying to get Lee. Go ahead. Go finish your talk.
Okay, no problem. Is the young man still there?
Go ahead. Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to say that. I guess the way that we raise and how we influenced by music. People know me for being around vocals, Motown, Philadelphia National. But my forte and genre of music is blues. And people say, as much as you like blues, you're an R&B singer.
Right.
Well, my grandfather, from segregated South, did blues on the guitar at 5, 6, 7, and 8.
Right.
So I was introduced to Hollingwolf, Jeff Foster, and Willie Dixon, the bass player who played with Hollingwolf, and Hubert, and all those people. So I knew about the blues from the South with the harmonica and the bass guitar. And I said to myself and other people, that was a great experience to me because I heard something in R&B that was always looking for blues.
Right.
So I like what this guy's saying.
Yeah.
But I'm just going to say this to you, that when I was teaching high school, there was a school called Creative and Performing Arts. It was called CAPA, right? I went inside this high school, and they did everything with dance and blues.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went into this classroom that was teaching these high school students blues, I was amazed. You know why? because all the musicians were white.
Right.
And I said to myself, the art of jazz needs to be still taught by black people. And I said, at one time, white folks couldn't play jazz because improvisation was so hard to do. You had to be up under some musicians to do it.
Right.
So the art of jazz is important, like the art of blues.
Yeah.
So
I agree.
When I see a young man like this that's willing to hand it down, I give him a round of applause.
Right. I agree. 100%. It's real critical. You know, and that is a big issue. And, you know, there's some jazz musicians, Caucasians, that, you know, can play. I mean, I like Dave Brubeck, you know, and like some of the music that he does. I'm not into a Glenn Miller, Benny Goodman, and all that stuff. That's out. But I do like Dave Brubeck and others. I mean, I guess they can do it, you know. But I agree. I agree with you, Brother Timothy. I really do. Okay. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. Let me go to 919-519. Caller, are you listening, or would you like to make a comment? 919-519. Are you listening, or would you like to make a comment?
Hello, just listening, really enjoying the show, just tune in.
Okay, good. Thank you so much, my brother. Appreciate it. Okay, all right. Brother Lush, how you doing tonight, my friend?
Good evening, Dr. Rogers. How you feeling today?
Doing good.
Good evening to your guest, Brother Olu. I got to ask, you know, since the beginning of this conversation, I have been hearing a lot of male names. Have there been any females through your travels that in your playing that you may have come across that really kind of lifted your eyebrows and made you kind of sit back in your chair and say, man,
right.
were there any females that you came across?
So let's go back to the beginning. Mr.
Yeah, answer that for us.
Top five hot seven. So Lil Armstrong was the pianist in his band. And she was, you know, to play with Louis Armstrong, you couldn't just be like a friend. You had to be good at your instrument. So Louis Armstrong was like one of the first. But, you know, the first that we know of. There's been a lot of great jazz pianists, female jazz pianists, black female. But, you know, music, jazz music, kind of would push women into playing, into being singers and piano more than the other instruments. Nowadays, in the last 20 years, changed, and they're becoming more accepted. I have to say that, like, at one time, Wynton Marsalis even made a comment that he couldn't see women being in the Lincoln Jazz Orchestra, but I think he's changed that now.
Okay.
But,
okay.
Yeah.
You know,
Simone, great vocalist and jazz pianist. Aretha Franklin actually was a pretty good pianist, too, and could play jazz.
Right.
But, more famous for singing.
What about Alice Coltrane?
Alice Coltrane was again, she was great.
Yeah.
Melba Liston, great jazz trombonist.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, Bobby Timmons.
Patrice Rushen, who's famous for Forget Me Not, a great jazz pianist, but and later on became, you know, like an R&B superstar.
Right.
And Bobby Humphrey on jazz flute.
Right, exactly.
So,
right.
A lot of great, but, you know, a lot of the history of black women in jazz has not been celebrated.
Right.
Actually, I'll say all of it has not been celebrated.
Not like it is with the men.
At the
yeah.
time, you know, they were big.
Yeah, they're definitely, Brother Lush, some others that are well, like, I think of the organist, Shirley Scott. She was
We played with Stanley Turrentine.
Yeah,
they were actually married for a while, but yeah, Shirley Scott and Turrentine.
Yeah, right. Shirley Scott was a brilliant organist, and so you know you had some like that, and but that's a good question, a good concern, because you don't get them bubbling on. Most of them are singers. You get a lot of the jazz singers, Diane Reeves, like that, for instance, and they or either like you said, keyboard. That's a question.
You know, most of the jazz singers could also play piano too, because Billie Holiday could play piano.
Yes, she could. Yeah, right. I heard her play. You know, one of the things I'm, Brother Lush, this might be of interest to you a little bit too. Some of this, what we're talking about, is based on socioeconomic circumstances.
Okay.
It has a lot to do with who you are, what part of the country, whether or not you got money, things like that. And case in point, I heard that Lionel Hampton only played for upscale gigs. He only played in that upper echelon of things. He didn't, and he was like a godfather. He was like the Quincy Jones of his day. And a lot of people came under him, like Donald Byrd. Quincy Jones came under him. And Lionel Hampton was, but he played those bourgeois parties. He played parties where, you know, the upper crust of Harlem, you know, Madam C.J. Walker, for instance, her daughter used to throw big, huge parties in Harlem. And she would bring in people like Lionel Hampton to play at her party or some of those kind of folk. That makes it interesting, too, you know, as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, brother, and thank you. And I'll continue to listen. Thank you.
Right. Good enough. Thank you so much.
Thanks for asking that question about women and jazz. It was very important.
Yeah, that is. That was a good question. Yep. Do you, Brother Sijuan, you have any more understanding on that class structure thing in jazz, that it is a class thing sometimes? Like I said, Lionel Hampton was a key, or Count Basie. Count Basie didn't play for everybody.
So the thing about Lionel Hampton that's interesting is that he was like the beginning of integrated big bands, because Benny Goodman chose Lionel Hampton and refused to play anywhere that wouldn't let him travel with Lionel Hampton.
Okay.
And I think I think maybe
interesting.
Christian, I could be wrong, but black jazz guitarist. But you know, so Hampton was sort of like the Jackie Robinson of the big bands. Like, he was recruited because of his musicianship, but, you know, Benny Goodman had to fight to get him into places.
Right.
And I don't know if that played into it, but, you know, black musicians are just like everybody else, like the brown bag rule in fraternities and a lot of clubs. Like, if you were too dark, you couldn't get in. If your skin was the right tone, you could get in. I mean, Duke Ellington was light, was fair complected, and I think at the Cotton Club, it was more like when you see the pictures, not a lot of dark-skinned people in there. I mean, darker-skinned black people. So, I mean, they're subject to the same thing as, you know, all of society was back then, like this colorism
right.
that was going on.
Yeah, a lot of colorism.
And I don't think it was
a lot of
music.
Colorism.
It was just that.
Yeah,
that was just prevalent throughout society.
Yep.
And, you know, thanks to Malcolm X for fighting that, and thanks to Marcus Garvey for fighting that.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks to,
mm-hmm.
you know, T.J. Walker and everybody else.
Right.
You know, that said, like, look, we need to be proud
exactly.
of our hues.
Exactly. You're right. Okay, let's go, Brother Herbie White. How you doing tonight, Brother Herbie?
Yeah, good evening, Dr. Rogers, and good evening to your guests.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, it's wonderful listening to this show.
Thank you.
Because, you know, everything that black people are involved in has a hidden history.
Yes.
It has a hidden history.
Yes, it is.
You know about the surface of it, but it has a very rich hidden history.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. like Brother Love said about the females. You know, what's her name? Cab Calloway's sister, Branch Calloway. She had her own band.
Right. Oh yeah, that's right. I forgot about her. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And Hazel Scott. What's her name's wife? Adam Clayton Powell's wife was a phenomenal piano player.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You
mm-hmm.
know.
Okay.
And you know, when you talk about the drug part, it's like Francis Quest Wilson said, the nine people activities.
Right.
You know, we suffer greatly no matter what we're doing.
That's true. No matter what.
No matter what you're doing, before you even get started.
Right.
The pain starts.
That's right.
So, you know, and then, you know, jazz is something that people have to look for.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't, you know, in the 50s and early 60s, there wasn't no black music on the radio anyway, at all.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the black stations started coming on, they wasn't playing jazz.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, so you, if you was a jazz fan, you had to go find it.
Right, right.
So I'm just grateful to be able to listen to all the information that the brothers provided.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Brother White. I really appreciate it. Just for informational purposes as well, there's another program. It comes on a different network, Blog Talk Radio. Comes on Monday evening called Gospel Gold. It's produced by Reverend Michael Rogers out of Holly Springs, North Carolina, pastor of First Baptist Church there. He does a program called Gospel Gold, but it's not about just playing gospel music. He does he does what we are doing now with jazz. And he intersects it, talks about his background, his history, talks about the artists and why they have chosen that, and looking at that whole world of gospel music. And if you may have an interest, it comes on at 6 Central Time, 7 Eastern Time on Blog Talk Radio. You just simply go to the Gospel Gold webpage and look at the and get a link if you want to listen internet. But I think you will find that as an enjoyable discussion as well, because he gets into that gospel. And we have, and a lot of genres of music we have like that, is done that, because, you know, it's like you said, it's power. It's who we are. It was a survival mechanism for a lot of us, you know, coming out of those turbulent years of Jim Crow and segregation, integration, all of that. You know, it carried us through. And I mean, I know that for a fact. I was a living witness to that. I know that music. The music is the one that pushed the civil rights movement forward. You know, we got energized when we sing, "I Ain't Gonna Turn Around No More." And we would agree with the picket signs on our way to Woolworth singing. And it gave us power and made you feel energized to go. So I know what music can do. And we need to pass that on to our kids, just like it can. There is some music that can be destructive. That music is also something that we even have to decipher as well, too. Okay, let me go to 414-324. You have a statement you'd like to make, or are you just listening?
Good evening, Dr. Rogers.
Oh, good evening. Good evening.
How you doing, brother?
Okay, good. Good. Who is this?
This is Oshi.
Oh, but Oshi. Hey, how you doing, Oshi? Okay.
I'm doing fine. Great topic. In Milwaukee, in the early 70s, there was a nightclub on the east side on Farwell called Teddy. And they brought great jazz greats to Milwaukee.
Okay.
At the time, and the reason why I know, because I went.
Okay, I wasn't here then, so I know.
The reason why I went is because my first wife, her brother was a saxophone player, and he loved jazz. He introduced me to jazz. He introduced me to Coltrane. His favorite saxophonist, the tenor sax, was Cannonball Adderley. But I got so many other great
love Cannonball
from him, you know. So I knew it. And so I saw Rashawn Roland Kirk.
I saw
Charlie Mingus, Stanley Turrentine, Eddie Hare. I could go on, man. Mm-hmm. I saw all these greats. Even Lloyd Ayres, before he went, you know, commercial.
Mm.
You know, he was still playing jazz.
Who owned that? Who owned that club?
Esther Phillips. I saw Esther Phillips.
Okay.
So I saw a number of people who were just giants in jazz at the time, you know. And of course, I maintain an affection. I don't buy a lot of music, but I definitely listen to it, and I listen to it on YouTube. And some of them I play on my radio program, at the top of the hour, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So,
excellent.
This is a great conversation, and that brought back those memories of the great jazz artists. And of course, we had some in Milwaukee.
Yeah. Did you go to the Jazz Oasis? Did you attend the?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I'm pretty sure you did. Yeah.
On Holy Street. Yeah.
Yeah. That's
You know, Burt Fudge.
Now, did you know Neil? Did you know Neil Chandick that passed last week?
No.
Okay. Yeah. Neil. He played Jazz Oasis. Mm-hmm.
Didn't know him.
Okay.
You know?
Okay. All right.
Yeah, there was some great jazz artists, you know, and of course, the ones today. And I think that what you hit on is very important, because the reason why our community is in the state that it's in, particularly our young people, is because of the music they listen to.
That's right.
You know.
Trust
me. When you are bombarded with music that, with the vulgarity and the imagery that you, that it conjures up because you're listening to it, you know, that's why all the negativity is happening within our community.
That's right.
You know.
That's right.
So it's very important what you listen to.
Especially now, like you said, because the technology is so readily available to them, they can listen to it in school. And you won't know it because you got their earphones on. And I'm sure some of the teachers are on top of that, but some are not.
Right.
Yeah, so, yeah, you're right. Okay. Thank you, Brother Osh. How you doing? What's your show about tomorrow?
I'm going to talk about Dr. Amos Wilson. Tomorrow's his birthday.
Okay, great.
And since it's our history month, I'm going to try to do a little in-depth thing on Dr. Amos Wilson.
Fantastic.
You know.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
All right, Dr.
It's good to hear from you, Osh.
All right. Thank you, my brother.
Okay. All right, let's go up here to 414-323. You want to ask the question or are you just listening? Okay, just listening. Great. Thank you so much for being on. Newbern, my brother from Newbern, 252.
Linda.
Hello, my brother. 252-474.
How you doing, boy?
Okay, good. How you doing?
Good conversation, man. Keep
all
up
right.
The good work, man. Just listen.
Good. Thank you. Okay. Right. I appreciate it.
You're right.
Someone has a radio on in the background. Someone has a radio on in the background. Could you please kind of just silence your mic? Okay. All right. Okay. I'm going to get to you in a minute, Brother Timothy. I just want to get all the rest of the folks.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
919-519. I did call you before, and you did say. What about 414-698?
Yes. Hello?
Hello. How are you?
I'm well. My name is Tanya Reed, and my mother,
okay.
Gave me the contact information and encouraged me to call in and listen tonight. This is truly a blessing and a pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much. Right, that's right. She said she was going to call you, her daughters, and ask them to listen. I really appreciate it. How you been? How you doing?
I'm doing well.
Good.
I'm really excited.
Okay.
Because on Thursday, in honor of Black History Month, I am hosting and presenting a show at the Conservatory of Music.
Oh, okay.
Memoirs of Song and Soul, and I will be performing there. My mentors were Melvin Rhines.
Okay.
And Betty Carter. And it's interesting because Betty Carter got her start with Lionel Hampton, actually.
That's right.
She sure did. Yes. And she also had the duet with Ray Charles. She was known for, I really can't stay.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Gotta go away.
All right.
So that's exciting. Also, Jerry Allen was a very well-known female pianist. So I wanted to put her name out there as well, because somebody brought up the female influence within the culture and the progression of the culture. But myself, I am a jazz vocalist, and I had classes at the conservatory and.
Okay.
With Melvin Rhine and Betty Carter's Jazz Ahead program.
Okay.
I was set on a trajectory to continue to carry the torch. And so I just hope to see, I wanted to use your platform. Thank you so much to just invite everybody.
Yes.
On this Thursday.
All right. What time?
Open at 6 o'clock. The doors open. And the show will start at 6:30. And I'll be talking about how I grew up in Milwaukee and my musical influence through my family and then through Mel and Ida Cola and then meeting Betty Carter.
That's right.
And and yeah, and just kind of matriculating through basically the last 100 years of music.
So let me ask you. Let me ask you what the brother was asking us. Brother Lush had asked about women and so forth. Why is it don't we hear more that you think about from women in this field? Because very clearly, I mean, they are the spirit of that, you know, and they have been used. You know, we know the Alice Coltranes, Shirley Scotts, you know, Betty Carter, as you say, you know, the Diane Reeds and so forth, but they basically were singers and piano players, you know. Now, I did notice, I was watching that ABC special about Summer of Soul, that Sly Stone had a lot of women playing saxophone and guitars and stuff like that. That was picked up. Well, Sly was unique in that way to do things like that. But why don't we see more of that? Is there something that we don't see that's at work, maybe that's masquerading itself, why women don't get into that?
Let's see.
You know
what? Well, I mean, our society. I mean, it's just we live in like more of a patriarchal.
Right. Okay. Okay. All right.
Right. You know, so that's just kind of fundamentally what we go by in terms of Western civilization.
Okay.
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know if it's just like, because I know a lot of people get exposed to their first instrument at the school level, like band.
Band. That's right.
So I don't know if maybe the teachers don't encourage the girls to do it, or maybe it just feels like more of a masculine thing to do. I really have no idea. I just know that I didn't get my lesson the way I was supposed to be getting my piano lesson. So I have basic kind of theory skills, and I understand key signatures and things like that. But I do a lot of things by ear, but I've had a lot of exposure to, technical musical training via piano. But, I was just a little not getting my lesson. But I definitely love to sing, and that's just me personally.
Okay, good.
So that's that. I don't know.
And I remember, I knew you sang, too, and I remember that. If I want to say, I think, didn't you do something for Hands by Sands?
My sister, Brandy, because we were in a trio, my mother.
Right.
Basically fostered and nurtured us, the Reed sisters.
Right.
And so Brandy, my older sister, got into acting.
Yes.
So perhaps she may have been a part of that.
Okay.
I'm not exactly
But I do
sure.
remember you all singing, and you all were beautiful, 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 beautiful voices.
Oh,
yeah, yes,
thank
indeed.
Thank you so much.
And well, I've always been in your, I've always been one of your fan club members.
Oh, well,
everything
well,
you
I'm
did.
I'm a fan now of you. I'm a fan of this show. I'm a fan of what you are doing. And
thank
everybody,
you.
Just creating that platform and allowing
right.
everybody a chance.
That's what we try to
tell
do.
Tell their story and ask their questions. So that's beautiful.
Yes, that's what we're trying to do. Okay, thank you so much. I love you to death.
All right.
Keep doing what
love
you're doing.
You more.
Okay, all right.
Thank you.
Take care. All right.
Bye.
Okay, Brother Bye. Timothy, I didn't forget you. Brother Timothy.
Yes, sir.
Go right ahead.
I wanted to say something about band leader Miles Davis. He did something, me as a blues person and a bass player, he did something that I wish it would have came to fruition. Him and Jimi Hendrix were going to do something together, and they asked Miles what it was about Jimi Hendrix and the tune that he did that he liked. He said, Machine Gun Man, Machine Gun. And my friends, yes, right, Machine Gun, So I have a friend that does drums, another friend that played guitar, and I did the bass. And we had a guy came in with the trumpet, and we tried to imagine what would Miles do with the trumpet. So, because they wanted to do it together, and I said to myself, that would have been a great thing, because Miles was very innovative, jazz, rock, fusion, he could do anything. He was innovative with adding different things. That was his brain.
Right.
And I said to myself, sometimes you need to add things with things for another art to be exposed.
Right.
That's what I like about Miles.
Okay.
It's my thing. Indeed. Have a good one.
All right.
It's a great show.
Great. Thank you so much, Brother Timothy. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Okay, Brother Sidwell, we've got about 8 more minutes. You want to say a few closing things or thoughts as we're moving out about this great world of jazz that I can't?
So I was going to say, after listening to Carla Reed, and I remember her and her sisters performing with Melvin Ryan, and again, she's one of, she is a great treasure in jazz. But there's other people that have left Milwaukee. Joe Sanders on bass. I mean, he left the High School of the Arts. Angela Johnson, Swan. I'm miss a lot of people, so I hate naming people because I know I miss people. Philip Duisak on trumpet. I mean, just in the last few years, Wynton Marsalis, piano player for the last 20 years. Daniel Nimmer, and Greg Tardy, great tenor saxophone player. Just a lot of people from Milwaukee, and from Wisconsin there's also a guy named Joel Fromm. But at the Jazz Oasis there was a great, great trumpet player, Brian, Brian Lynch. So he's like a legendary jazz trumpet player in New York, and the piano player that used to be in charge of the jazz department at the conservatory. This name will come to me too, but a lot of musicians have gone to New York, made international names for themselves. It seems like people do feel like they have to go to New York. Frank Morgan went to New York. He came back for a while and then passed away several years ago.
Right.
But, you know, Milwaukee, musicians here, like Berkeley Plus, a lot of them, and Manti Ellis stayed here. They could have been in New York. And
they could have done right, yeah.
Household names.
Yeah, definitely.
But we just know them here, and we should be thankful that we had, you know, Melvin Ryan here, and we, you know, Manti Ellis and Atticola. There's so many other great musicians. Mary, the pianist, Mary Davis.
Yeah, Berkeley Fudge.
People like that.
Yeah, Berkeley Fudge was really good. He was great. Yeah, I like Berkeley. That's great. That's really great. Brother Kwasi, you want to say anything? Since you know your other half is on here, did you want to say something?
I was just waiting for him to mention Sonia. I thought she played the violin, and did she play some jazz? Because when she came to Milwaukee, you guys played together a couple times at Fister.
Yeah, so Sonia Robinson was acclaimed by Miles Davis. He actually wrote on Sonia's first album, Notes, that if you want to, you know, check out, like, what the state of jazz, you want to listen to Sonia Robinson. So she was first known as Miss Black America to the rest of the nation, but I knew her as this great violin player. And she was in New York for a long time, and she's played with a lot of like the great hard bop and post bop jazz people in New York. So a lot of people know her. Awesome composer. Wrote a lot of politically tinted music too. So she again is one of those artists that's aware, not just playing music for, I won't say entertainment, but also playing music for enlightenment too. Yeah, but Sonia, just another of Milwaukee's great treasures to come out here. And she influenced a lot of like violinists that came after her, and just like Regina Carter. Said that they listened to Sonia, they saw Sonia, and they thought, jazz violinist, I think I want to do that. Because at the time, there weren't a lot of jazz violinists, period, let alone Black woman. Actually, there weren't any other Black women. I think Sonia was the first.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about Sonia Robinson. Did you say something about she was at a Miss Black America pageant or something? Was that here in Milwaukee?
It wasn't in Milwaukee. This was like back in '83, I think she won that. 1983.
Okay. All right. Great.
Yeah, and I don't know where it was at, but
when Ebony's Most Beautiful Women in America, it was in the Ebony magazine in that.
Okay, all right, okay, great. Well, this has definitely been great, my brother, and I really appreciate you for what you have said and shared with us. It's a lot of stuff here. You know, we couldn't dare cover this in 2 hours. We can't even cover one segment of it. So it's so much to go, but I just wanted to talk about a lot of that. This was, as you said, this was Black Liberation Month. We've been looking at some things, and we're just kind of looking at those survival tools, those survival tactics that we use. We got to do that more and more. I think we're going to really need to get ready to do survival tools, you know, the way this world is going and the way it's turning out. We're going to have to learn to always grab on to survival tactics, you know, and use those and employ those in our families and communities to be able to keep it going. And this has definitely been a good discussion and showing how music does that. Music is a wonderful gift from the Creator. Reminds me of the great W.E. Du Bois in his book, The Souls of Black Folk. And he commented on spiritual gospel music. He said, it's the sweetest music on this side of heaven. And Du Bois was basically, he wasn't an atheist, but he was an agnostic about things. And he made that comment. And so that's why all of our music forms are very important. And so don't forget that starting next week, the Gospel Gold program comes back on, and you'll be able to listen to that. They had been off for a while. This is their new season coming up, and I think they've got a lot of stuff that they're working on. So listen to that, and we're going to review this again, too, with this world of jazz. We come at it from obviously a different perspective and kind of look at it in that way. So we thank all of you, all of your comments that you've made, and we hope you have a really very good week, and hopefully you can you'll be with us next week. We'll be right here again at 7 o'clock Central, 8 o'clock Eastern, dealing with what we got to deal with. So one of the great forms of jazz has always been Latin jazz. You know, jazz had a very strong Latin connection as well.
Yeah.
So we're going to close out tonight with a dynamic Latin jazz piece that I think some of you might know about, but we want to play. Thank you so much again, brother, and we will definitely talk very soon, okay?
All right, hold up.
Okay.
Esa negrita que va caminando, esa negrita tiene su tumbao, y cuando la gente la va mirando, ella baila de lado, también apretado, apretado, apretado.
La negra tiene tumbao.
Azúcar.
Sick.
cosa de la noche dulce como el melao. Otra como esa yo nunca he encontrado.